I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. On Wednesday, Simone Biles, Michaela Maroney, Maggie Nichols, and Ali Raisman testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee. All are champion gymnasts. All are survivors of sexual abuse committed by the former USA Gymnastics physician, Larry Nassar. In 2018, Nassar pleaded guilty to sexual assault and is now serving up to 175 years in prison. But he is not the only perpetrator who harmed these athletes. Here's Simone Biles.
I blame Larry Nassar, and I also blame an entire system that enabled and perpetrated his abuse.
An entire system. Now, the purpose of Wednesday's Senate hearing was to determine the extent to which the FBI contributed to that system. The testimonies publicly aired the shocking findings of the report from the Office of the Inspector General. After receiving tips about Nassar's abuse, it took more than 17 months for the FBI to even follow up. The special agent in charge of the Indianapolis office, Jay Abbott, actually interviewed for a job at USA Gymnastics after hearing direct testimony from a gymnast about being abused by Nassar. The pain, suffering, and anger of survivors was readily and righteously apparent in these testimonies. Here's Michaela Maroney.
By not taking immediate action from my report, they allowed a child molester to go free for more than a year. And this inaction directly allowed Nassar's abuse to continue. What is the point of reporting abuse if our own FBI agents are going to take it upon themselves to bury that report in a drawer? They had legal, legitimate evidence of child abuse and did nothing. If they're not going to protect me, I want to know, who are they trying to protect?
And Maggie Nichols.
In sacrificing my childhood for the chance to compete for the United States, I am haunted by the fact that even after I reported my abuse, so many women and girls had to suffer at the hands of Larry Nassar. USA Gymnastics and the United States Olympic and Paralympic Committee and the FBI have all betrayed me and those who were abused by Larry Nassar after I reported.
And Ali Raisman.
Over the past few years, it has become painfully clear how a survivor's healing is affected by the handling of their abuse. And it disgusts me that we are still fighting for the most basic answers and accountability over 6 years later.
And it was Simone Biles who asked the question posed by Rachel Den Hollander, the attorney, retired gymnast, and survivor who first broke silence about Nassar's abuse.
How much is a little girl worth?
And with us now is Rachel Den Hollander. She's a speaker and author of the book, What is a Girl Worth? My Story of Breaking the Silence and Exposing the Truth About Larry Nassar and USA Gymnastics. Rachel, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
What was your reaction to the powerful testimony from those champion gymnasts we heard from yesterday?
I am incredibly proud of those women and what they've accomplished. But it's also an incredible weight to hear over and over again, to sit with the reality that so many little girls could have been saved. And the reality that we weren't just fighting an abuser, we were fighting an entire system. You know, and unfortunately, this is the story that so many sexual assault survivors know. When I did come forward to the police in 2016, I came with a thick file of evidence, you know, character witnesses and prior disclosures and my medical records and actually a legal memorandum where I laid out Michigan law and I argued the case right there for the detective and the prosecutor. And the reason I did this is because I was 100% confident in 2016 that this is what we would find, that we would find multiple layers of cover-up and corruption. Because this is the story so many sexual assault survivors face. It is incredibly difficult to get law enforcement to take reports of sexual abuse seriously. And what we saw yesterday is just a blown up image of what survivors go through every day. And we have got to start asking the question how we hold law enforcement accountable for this kind of gross negligence and corruption, and how we do a better job with our training and our education and our cultural response so that this doesn't keep happening to little girls and women and little boys all over the country.
Rachel, as you talk about that file that you came forward with, it occurs to me, is that why you went to law school? Was that part of the motivation, that capacity to be able to advocate for yourself?
You know, it actually wasn't. I decided to go to law school when I was 10 because I wanted to protect children. But I can say that the training was invaluable, and I can't imagine trying to navigate the legal system and to fight the system when you don't have that kind of legal training. You know, in the end, the only reason anything happened in our case was because we had an incredible detective, Detective Andrea Mumford, who pursued the investigation so quickly. And she did more in 1 month's time than the FBI managed to do in 17 months. And then we had an incredible prosecutor, Angela Povilaitis, who took our files and she said, I'm going to fight for every one of them. And she kept her word. But most survivors don't have that benefit. And so to try to navigate our justice system without any kind of legal training, not even knowing what's normal, what to expect, and then to be fighting the detectives and the prosecutors the entire time, it's just an untenable situation for survivors. It's trauma upon trauma for them.
That distinction that you just drew for us between the Michigan law enforcement officials who you were able to work with, you know, you wrote about in your Washington Post piece that, in fact, you know, they did get more done than the FBI did in the same period of time when they did basically nothing. What does that at least suggest to you about what was going on at the FBI?
I think it's absolutely clear, you know, in the 15 months between when those four women first reported their abuse and then when I reported my abuse, and that's what made it hit headlines and actually blow up. And that's what forced the FBI's hand to pretend that they had been doing something. In that 15 months, they did essentially nothing. And Larry was in that exam room abusing little girls every single day. But it was also 15 months between when I made my police report and when Larry pled guilty. And in that 15 months, Andrea and Angela were able to process over 100 police reports, start a Title IX investigation. In 48 hours, Larry was out of the exam room permanently. They found the CSAM on his hard drive. They secured a plea deal that protected every single one of our voices. And what that tells us when you put it side by side is that this can be done. We can fight child abuse. We can stop sexual assault. We can stop abusers. But we can only do it if we have law enforcement and prosecutors who want to do the right thing, who are trained to do the right thing, and who are motivated to do the right thing. And we clearly did not have that at any of the three field offices who received reports of Larry's abuse.
Michaela Moroney spoke of being of her abuse being diminished, that she was made to feel irrelevant, unimportant by the FBI agents with whom she spoke. That, again, when you talk about what Andrea and Angela were able to do out of Michigan, what systemically can we do to make sure that survivors are meeting up with the Andrea and Angelas of the world and not with the kind of special agents that Michaela had to deal with?
Yeah, you're right. The contrast between how Michaela was treated and how I was treated is just night and day different. And in my case, it led to just incredible healing because they were the first people outside of my family to ever fight for me. And in Michaela's case, it led to deep re-traumatization because of how she was treated. You know, the answer to your question, how do we make sure survivors meet up with an Andrea and an Angela? We have to have more of them to start with. That means we have to pursue good education and training for our detectives and our prosecutors. That requires funding. We have to start pursuing the stopping of child abuse and sexual assault like it actually matters. And that requires putting our money where our mouth is. Right now, most prosecutors and detectives just aren't trained, and they're not compensated in a way that makes it worth their while to stay at a job that is so painful and so difficult to be immersed in that kind of trauma. So we're not putting our money where our mouth is, for starters. But the other layer to that is we don't have any mechanism for holding law enforcement and prosecutors accountable who do engage in gross negligence and outright corruption. Our sovereign immunity laws in the United States put almost a complete bar to any kind of criminal prosecution and certainly any kind of civil justice for individuals who are harmed by gross negligence and outright corruption in our law enforcement. The reality is, because of our sovereign immunity doctrines, we have created a situation where we are completely dependent on our law enforcement and prosecutors. And law enforcement and prosecutors hold untenable power, almost unbridled power. And yet there is no mechanism for accountability and responsibility. We have to start having a very serious discussion about qualified and sovereign immunity in the United States and how we hold law enforcement accountable for this kind of behavior.
The FBI director yesterday spoke and talked about having dismissed the person who treated Michaela in that way, and yet also suggested, well, now that he's no longer on, a member of the FBI, there isn't much we can do. And I got to say, that felt a little enraging for me.
Yes, absolutely. Because the reality is, not only were those women re-traumatized by the way they were treated, but over 100 little girls were sexually abused by Larry in the 15 months that the FBI was not just sitting on those reports, but intentionally not pursuing those reports. As you mentioned, engaging in wining and dining with Steve Penny, the president of USAG, and entertaining a cushy job offer, and then lied about it for 5 years. To the Department of Justice, to us, to Andrea and Angela. And if you talk to Andrea and Angela, they'll tell you what a difficult time they had in their prosecution getting any kind of cooperation or help from the FBI. They weren't allowed to access reports. They weren't given the information they asked for. The FBI made all kinds of promises, even after I came forward, that they were going to do certain things that they never did, including protecting the survivors' voices and just identifying a medical expert. Everything that got done by Andrea and Angie. In this case,
you're the final survivor to deliver an impact statement when Nassar was sentenced. If you had the opportunity to deliver an impact statement to the FBI about their handling of these cases, what would you say?
Yeah, it is the same message I've been saying the entire time. How much is a little girl worth? How much is a child worth? How much is a woman, a person worth? Because really, our behavior shows what we value and prioritize. And what the FBI has communicated for 5 years is they do not value people. They do not value the truth. They do not value what is right. And with no mechanism to hold them accountable, that puts survivors in an absolutely untenable situation. It has got to change.
As a survivor myself and the mother of two little girls, thank you for raising that question. Rachel Denhollander is attorney, author, advocate, survivor, speaker, inspiration. Thank you so much for your voice, your work, and for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I don't want another young gymnast, Olympic athlete, or any individual to experience the horror that I and hundreds of others have endured before, during, and continuing to this day in the wake of the Larry Nassar abuse. Sorry.
On Wednesday, while testifying in front of the Senate, FBI Director Christopher Wray apologized to the survivors of former USA gymnastics doctor Larry Nassar.
I'm deeply and profoundly sorry to each and every one of you. I'm sorry that so many different people let you down over and over again. And I'm especially sorry that there were people at the FBI who had their own chance to stop this monster back in 2015 and failed.
With me now is V, formerly known as Eve Ensler. V is the creator of many works, including The Vagina Monologues and The Apology. Welcome to the show, V.
Thank you, Melissa. So glad to be with you this morning.
Let me ask, did you watch the testimonies yesterday?
I did, with great interest and kind of obsession, to be honest. I did. And I just, let me begin by saying that my heart is with every one of those incredible young women gymnast survivors. This should never have happened to you. And I bow to your bravery. I admire your solidarity and sisterhood. And I stand with you in your complete pursuit of justice.
When I hear you say that, particularly their sisterhood, the idea that they, at least on the other side of this abuse, as they are now working through all of the lifelong consequences of it, they do at least have one another. And I want to start with your book, The Apology, because I have to say I thought of it immediately as I listened to FBI Director Ray making this apology. You and I have talked about this before, but you wrote it as an extended apology to yourself, but in the voice of your late father, who began sexually abusing you at the age of 5 and died without ever offering an apology. As you listened to the FBI director, what did you hear?
Well, I feel like it's a beginning, right? But I think there's many layers of apologies, right? Apologies are acknowledgement of harm done. So he was doing that. but it's also a detailed accounting of that harm that that agency did, which needs to come to the light of day. An apology reveals that that person apologizing actually understands and has compassion and care. And it transformed the conditions that really bring about the abuse. In the case of the FBI, it would be rooting out all the ways that system has completely failed thousands of victims. So he did the top layer of the apology, and now the many other layers need to follow, right?
Talk to me about sort of maybe walk through some of those layers relative to survivors. Sort of, I was so struck. Actually, let's just listen for a moment. I want to listen for a moment to something that you said in your TED Talk back in 2020.
I have never heard a man who has committed rape or physical violence ever publicly apologize to his victim.
When I heard you say that, it was also for me the first time I realized I'd never heard that kind of apology. What is the value of that kind of apology for survivors?
Well, I just was thinking about one of the young women yesterday was talking about how she was treated when she told, I think it was an FBI agent, what had happened to her.
I began crying at the memory over the phone, and there was just dead silence. I was so shocked at the agent's silence and disregard for my trauma. After that minute of silence, he asked, "Is that all?" Those words in itself was one of the worst moments of this entire process for me. To have my abuse be minimized and disregarded by the people who were supposed to protect me, just to feel like my abuse was not enough. But the truth is, my abuse was enough, and they wanted to cover it up. USA Gymnastics, in concert with the FBI and the Olympic Committee, were working together to conceal that Larry Nassar was a predator.
She said it was the most devastating moment of all that had happened, even the abuse, because we know survivors' healing is often determined by how their abuse is handled. And if you're not believed, if your abuse is minimized, if you're made to feel crazy and guilty, like your life isn't as significant as your perpetrator's life, if you're treated like you're crazy or extreme or the enemy, it will totally impact your future, which has already been radically altered by the abuse. And it will shake your confidence, your ability to trust your own experience in the world. It will make your self-worth diminish it. It will make you feel actually like invisible in all of the systems and structures that we exist in. So what apology does is the opposite, right? It actually says, I see you and I acknowledge that what you believe to be true, what you believe happened to you, actually happened to you. And I, as the perpetrator, am going to spell out in detail what that is that happened to you. I'm also going to investigate myself or my agency, because these are predatory agencies. These are predatory organizations, enabling organizations. I'm going to investigate my organization or my being and see, how did we become an FBI that is capable of not only covering this up, but awarding people who cover this up, who know something is going on, who don't protect other people from that exact same thing over a course of a year and a half. What are the steps that made this organization so patriarchal, so siding with power and the proximity to power, that we don't go into depth to find out how we protect young girls? And then the third step is looking at the impact of that abuse. Like, if I have raped you, what are the long-term consequences of that abuse? How will that affect your life? What will that do to your daily sense of trust and intimacy and to your body? Will it get infections? Will it have illnesses? Will you be able to have memory? Because we know that when survivors are raped or when they are abused, they check out and they have to begin kind of disabling their memory so it doesn't lead them back to the horror. So it has a huge impact on your memory. And in the case of Simone Biles, maybe we can talk about this now.
The scars of this horrific abuse continue to live with all of us. As the lone competitor in the recent Tokyo Games who was a survivor of this horror, I can assure you that the impacts of this man's abuse are not ever over or forgotten. The announcement in the spring of 2020 that the Tokyo Games were to be postponed for a year meant that I would be going to the gym, to training, to therapy, living daily among the reminders of this story for another 365 days. As I have stated in the past, one thing that helped me push each and every day was the goal of not allowing this crisis to be ignored. I worked incredibly hard to make sure that my presence could maintain a connection between the failures and the competition at Tokyo 2020. That has proven to be an exceptionally difficult burden for me to carry, particularly when required to travel to Tokyo without the support of any of my family. I am a strong individual and I will persevere, but I never should have been left alone to suffer the abuse of Larry Nassar. And the only reason I did was because of the failures that lie at the heart of the abuse that you are now asked to investigate.
You know, I've thought so much about this notion of twisties that she had during the Olympics in Japan. And to me, if it's not a direct consequence, it's certainly such a powerful metaphor that it operates on the same level. But literally what a twisty is that you separate, your mind and your body separate as you're flying through the air, so that you have no notion of where you will land it, and you basically lose complete control of your body. You can talk to 1,000 survivors and you will discover that when you are being invaded by somebody else, when somebody enters your body without consent, particularly as a child, having had that experience from 5 to 10, you leave your body, you disassociate, you have no idea where you're literally spinning in air, and you have no idea where you're going to land. And you feel at that moment that you have lost control of your body. And it takes many, many, many years to feel like you have agency over your body again. So I know that's going off on a little diversion, but I feel like an apology would be looking at all those things. Why did Simone Biles, why was she unable to participate? You know, the consequences of sexual abuse don't happen the day after. They can happen 50 years later. They can happen 3 weeks later. They can happen 10 years later. The trauma lives in your body. It's almost like some dormant hand grenade that can get triggered by some experience and just blow up. And tension can do it. Stress can do it. Memory can do it. It can just blow up that experience in your body where you suddenly become. I remember hearing the story of a nurse who had been abused when she was a child. And one day her body just went completely numb. She became paralyzed and no one could figure it out. And finally they uncovered that she and her sisters had been being abused by her father her whole childhood. But it didn't happen till 40 years later that the consequences of that came out.
I so appreciate your discussion of the twisties. It is 100% how I read that at the time as a survivor. It's what it sounded like to me, that dissociation, that lack of trust in your own judgment, in your own body, knowing that she was the only survivor of Nassar's abuse who was at the Tokyo Olympics, and knowing that her family was not there. And it felt like I knew that all of us who'd experienced our own personal twisties, even if we're not gymnasts, felt and heard that. And so I appreciate you acknowledging it and making that clear. I have one more, what I think is a little bit of a tough question, but I'm so moved by your book, by the apology, that I feel like you're a safe person to go here with. So we heard Director Ray call Larry Nassar a monster. And certainly, especially given what you've just laid out, there's no question the effects of his abuse are monstrous. At the same time, being a student of Dr. Maya Angelou's, she taught us never to call even the most horrifying acts that are done by humans the act of monsters, because she wanted us to remember that all of us are human, and in being human, we are capable of great evil and of great good, and that we have to face that it is humans who are doing this. You actually wrote a book from the perspective of your father. You stepped in to him. You tried to have some level of empathy, even as you forced his departed spirit to account for the abuse. I'm wondering how you think about that issue of monstrosity.
Well, I agree with Maya Angelou and I agree with Hannah Arendt, you know, that the evil is usually pretty mundane and that each of us has this capacity to do terrible things. And if it were only a few, quote, monstrous men who were raping and abusing women, 1 billion women on the planet wouldn't be beaten or raped in their lifetimes. Mm-hmm. So we know it's pretty much part of the human condition. I think doing that investigation of my father led me into the inside of my father to look at a culture, right, that supported my father, that bred my father, that encouraged my father to become a person who had so much asymmetrical and unleashed, unfettered power, right, that he could do what he wanted. And I think one of the things, all of these terrible, terrible cases of young women have shown us is it's not just the Larry Nassers, I'm just gonna say this, it's all the enablers who are part of this story. The enablers who, the FBI, the USAG, the USOPC, all the people around Larry Nassar who were being, you know, he served that agency and he got these girls who weren't, who were doing really the bidding and winning all these things, but had absolutely no protection as they were being used, right? And I think one of the things we've seen in these last years, whether it's Trump or Weinstein or Epstein or Cosby or Cuomo, right? It's a community of enablers that keep the predator going for years, even after, you know, even after they're called out and off, and sometimes after they're even prosecuted. And in the case of Cuomo, he was accused by 11 women of sexual harassment, and we had Time's Up, who in theory was meant to support victims bringing their perpetrators to trial. And executives were among those who advised the governor's office on a draft or op-ed to seek to discredit a victim, right? So we know that this proximity to power changes people's perspective and often silences people. And I will say that whoever Larry Nassar is, he was made in patriarchy. Do you know what I mean? He was created in patriarchy. He was bred here in his family, in the culture, everything around him. And he really was allowed to, I mean, when you think of the years he did this, you think of thousands of girls, how long this went on, how many people must have turned away, made excuses, said Larry Nassar's career and his standing and his power is more important than thousands of girls. And I just want to say that line that Simone Biles said yesterday, you know, what is the life of a little girl worth? To me, that should be the cry of this culture. You know, it's certainly the cry of my life. It's what got me into devoting my life to ending violence against women and girls, because I didn't feel that the life of a little girl mattered to anyone. And the kind of just silence and the kind of desperation I felt as a child, a little girl, having nobody to reach out to, nobody to turn to. I don't want any other little girl in our culture to ever experience that again. You know, and that requires us looking at what makes a Larry Nassar, what in his family, what in the culture sustains Larry Nassar, you know, what in his own being gave him the sense that he had a right to do, but also the strange perversion of doing that to girls he was in theory training to be athletes. He was undermining them as he was training them, right?
V, formerly known as Eve Ensler, is a playwright, an author, an advocate, creator of The Vagina Monologues, writer of The Apology. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. There are many reasons to love web-based innovation. Platforms like Zoom kept us connected in a pandemic. iPhoto lets us instantly share our pics with far-flung family. And with Twitter, we find communities to express ourselves, sell products, and even watch sports from across the miles. One of my favorites is JibJab. Okay, JibJab is an app that allows you to upload a picture of yourself onto the body of a dancing elf or an adorable puppy. Aww. You can even put your head on the body of an animated James Brown.
I gotta be human. Hey, let me tell you.
Just point, click, hit send, and within moments, your best friend is rocking out to a birthday card featuring a mashup of you and the Godfather of Soul.
That ain't right, you Harlan Gust. Gotta deal with it.
Easy face swapping technology is great when it's silly, consensual, animated fun. But as many people know, there's a more sinister side: deep fakes. Deepfakes first emerged within pornography, and most remain pornographic in nature. Deepfakes use AI technology to take the faces of unsuspecting, non-consenting women and put them onto the bodies of people in pornographic videos. These are not adorable holiday animations, and typically, it's not even obvious that they're fake. Up until now, deepfakes required significant coding skills. But now, there's a new app that makes it possible for almost anyone to point, click, hit send, and within moments, your boss is watching what appears to be a genuine video of you engage in explicit sexual acts. For more on this, we spoke with Rebecca Delfino, law professor at LMU Loyola Law School in Los Angeles, and Karen Howe, the senior AI editor at MIT Technology Review. Rebecca started by explaining a bit more about the complicated world of deepfake technology.
So deepfakes emerged on the internet as we know them now in about the end of 2017, and it started on Reddit, in fact, through a Reddit user who developed the concept of mapping one person's face onto the body of another person, and it started in the context of pornography.
It actually began with pornography.
It did. The individual who coined the term deepfake on Reddit was taking images of the face of famous actresses and placing them on the bodies of women engaged in intimate and pornographic acts. And then this individual then posted them on the Reddit site that they had created.
So, Karen, I'm assuming that this is pretty clearly non-consensual porn.
Absolutely. I mean, a consensual porn is when the person being portrayed in the pornography actually willingly participates and even knows that it's happening. And in this particular case, the Reddit user absolutely did not in any way ask for the consent of these female celebrities. And many of the female celebrities felt quite traumatized when they discovered that their image was being manipulated in this way.
Now, Karen, I think of myself not as a complete Luddite, you know, as having a few tech skills. I can cut a little sound for a radio show here and there, but I don't think that I'd be able to make something like this that didn't look, you know, kind of obviously fake. Has the technology evolved to a point where even someone who is a novice can create these deepfakes?
Unfortunately, yes. So back in 2017, it was still a quite complicated process. There were essentially AI algorithms that were open sourced online, and you needed to understand how to code in order to use it to do this kind of face swap and impose these female celebrities' faces onto porn star bodies. But what we've seen over the last 4 years is the technology has gotten easier and easier from a user experience perspective, where it's packaged into these consumer type apps where you literally just have to push a button to do the same kind of face swapping. So unfortunately, what we've seen, I just recently wrote this article about this new service, the latest service in this vein that came out that does exactly this. You upload a single photo, you push a couple buttons, and then immediately the image of the woman in the photo that you upload is now transposed onto a porn star.
Okay, Rebecca, you said that deepfake technology emerged in the context of non-consensual porn here, but is it pervasive? I mean, if someone is, using a porn site, how likely is it that they may encounter something which is actually a deep fake?
It's actually quite likely now. The prevalence of deepfakes that appear in the pornographic space is exploded, in fact, in the last 2 years. Entities that have studied and have tracked deepfakes have estimated that 96% of the deepfake videos online are pornographic, and that 90% of them are women. And just to give you a sense of those numbers, in July of 2019, there were about 15,000 deepfakes that involved pornography. A year later, there were 50,000, and the entities that are tracking this predict that the growth will continue by a factor of 2 every 6 months. So it is a virtual explosion of deepfake pornographic videos on the internet.
All right, Karen, why should we care? I mean, it's not really these women. It's not really their bodies. If your, you know, face is out there as a celebrity, you could be out there as a celebrity in all kinds of different images. Why does it even matter?
Right. I mean, there are some very severe consequences that come out of this kind of deepfake pornographic abuse, essentially. One is the psychological impact that it has on these women. It's very traumatizing to see your image represented in such a different way from what you see yourself as. And it exists on the internet basically forever. So it very much ends up having these like economic and interpersonal impacts, the same as real revenge porn might. Every time you go to a job interview, you might have to confront an answer for this pornographic image of you that you never even knew existed. Every time you go on a date, you have to answer to the person that you're dating. And there have already been multiple cases of women that have been harassed with rape and death threats because the public doesn't know that they're not real. They think that they're real, or who have lost their jobs. There was this teacher who lost her job after the school discovered these images, believed that they were real. And even if they weren't real, they thought that it was inappropriate for a teacher with that kind of imagery online to be then teaching students. So the repercussions are extremely real. So this is a story that I heard from the UK government-funded entity, Revenge Porn Hotline. They're a nonprofit organization that helps women who are the victim of revenge porn and what they've seen over the last couple years, and particularly during the pandemic, is an uptick in faked pornography and specifically deepfaked revenge porn. And they heard from this teacher who called into the service saying, I have no idea where these images came from or who's making these of me. Many people don't even know that deepfakes exist. So according to her, the school just didn't understand when she was like, this isn't me, this is fake. That concept is really hard to wrap your head around because the images can be so realistic now that it looks like it is you. So I think that cognitive dissonance caused the school to be extremely concerned about continuing to employ the teacher. They probably were wondering what the kids might think if they discover this, what parents might think if they discover this, and the impending confusion they just didn't want to have to deal with.
So, Rebecca, what kind of legal recourse would someone have in a situation, whether it's like that or whether it's a celebrity or even if someone just pulls your image off of your own social media site, like your Facebook page? What can you do about it?
Well, unfortunately, right now, in many places, there's very little that can be done aside from contacting the platforms and asking them to take the image down. But as Karen suggested, even if you can get a media platform to take it down, it still is out there and it can be copied and disseminated. And so it's difficult for people to get a handle on it once it's been released. But in terms of the legality of it, currently the United States, federally, we don't have a national criminal law that speaks to this particular problem. And I wrote an article, in fact, in 2019 that came out that discussed the need for that. Some work has been done and some legislation has been proposed at the federal level, but it is not really emerged out of the various committees in Congress. So then it requires that folks look to the states where they live to see if there is a recourse for them. And currently there's only one state in the nation, Virginia, that has a law that criminalizes the distribution and creation of deepfakes. And in Virginia, what they did is Virginia is one of the 46 states that actually has revenge porn crime. And they took the revenge porn crime and they amended the definition to include the concept of these simulated deepfake pornographic images. So now if you live in Virginia, of course, it's you can complain and perhaps obtain a prosecution.
Given that you're saying Virginia, which is not typically the most like progressive out in front on these kinds of things per se, I'm wondering if that's about politicians. Is that about basically DC folks not wanting or wanting to have recourse if this happens to them?
That's an interesting question. So I don't know the answer, but often in these when it comes to laws that are protecting women and girls, politicians are often motivated by something that is personal to them. And I suspect that in Virginia, the motivation might have been because the individual legislators who proposed it, someone brought it to them, their attention and said, hey, this has happened to someone that we know. That tends to be where these laws get traction and attention. And in addition to, there may be some truth to what you suggest that the political class that is close to DC is also concerned about the impacts of these crimes.
So we've talked about it kind of using, Karen, the shorthand of women, and this happens to women. Does this mostly happen to women, exclusively happen to women? Are there men who are also victimized by this? And I almost hate to ask, but children.
Right. So Rebecca mentioned a stat earlier that 90% of non-consensual deepfake porn is made of women. And probably when they say women, they really mean like females. So perhaps they might be 17, 16, 15. We don't know. There have certainly been known instances of this kind of technology being used on underage girls. But to the extent, we don't know the extent because it's sort of hard. Like many of these victims are not known by name. It's sort of just image forensicists are looking at the images and trying to figure out how young they look. And it does, in rare occasions, also happen to men. I mean, in the service that I discovered and reported on earlier this week, it also allows for face swapping of men onto gay porn. And if you think about the fact that being homosexual is criminalized in certain countries by the death penalty, that could have also severe consequences for men. But I do think that by far, the consequences really, the brunt of it is really felt by women and maybe some underage girls.
Rebecca, I'm wondering if there are other kinds of policies at either the state or federal level, maybe sort of mapping that Virginia policy, if that's sufficient, or if there are other ways that federal and state policy can address this.
Right. So I think there are a number of things that can be done, and a lot of it's going to involve inviting the private sector in, the media, social media companies, those that control the space in which we live on the internet, policies that can encourage them or incentivize them policing their sites and being more responsive to takedown requests in a swifter manner. I know that Facebook and Google are working on developing greater responsiveness to these issues, but encouragement at the federal level or in the state level as well. I know in the last year, there have been legislation that is targeted sites such as Pornhub, requiring them, you know, sort of making them responsible if they are posting certain things that are pornographic.
Rebecca Delfino is a law professor at LMU Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. And Karen Howe is a senior AI editor at MIT Technology Review. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, all. Very heavy show today. And we appreciate you sticking it out and hopefully learning some things. But listen, we wanted to hook y'all up with some bright spots today as well. And we have another Slice of Life audio snippet from y'all out there. This is an enterprising young audio producer who pretty much sent us a whole fruit of her day.
I'm Jay Shaw, a journalism student in the graduate program at Kent State. The pandemic has forced some major life changes upon us, and I'm here to take you on my journey of self-discovery through this time. Life feels mundane and upside down at the same time, but things have been interesting as well. I got married during the pandemic, My husband Jack and I bought a house that we moved into a few months later. And then we adopted a little kitten named Beetlebub. His name is a combination of Beetlejuice and Beelzebub. Him and our other cat, Santiago, are welcome distractions while we're stuck working from home. It's almost like a Discovery Channel show, except instead of a panther and a lynx in the wild, we have our psycho and maniac wreaking havoc in our carpeted living room. They're usually always in the middle of, well, everything. All right, let's do this. Whoa! Why? Why? Why do you hate me, Jack?
You didn't realize that, like, that alarm goes off every day.
I do realize.
One thing has stayed the same throughout this pandemic. I'm not a morning person, and I love hitting the snooze button. Getting out of bed always requires that extra 5 minutes of either laying in bed and doom scrolling through social media, or simply staring up at the ceiling until my body starts. My brain, on the other hand, never shuts off.
No, I hit stop. I just have like 50,000 alarms. Anyway, leave me bed.
This is also the time when Santiago snuggles into bed to make up for all the lost time from being kicked out at night. Right now, he is tucked under Jack's arm. He's so comfy and purring. My pre-pandemic life did not require a complex routine. I made coffee every morning before class or work, and depending on how early, I would either grab some fruit to go or occasionally treat myself to a breakfast sandwich from Dunkin' Donuts. Now, I wake up, doom scroll through social media and my emails, make myself coffee, and walk into the other room for class or my internship. My mental health has taken a direct hit, but I've been trying to implement a more extensive and healthy routine. I found it through BuzzFeed News called the Billionaire Routine. Obviously, I'm not going to do every single thing listed in that routine, and I don't expect to become a billionaire. But I'm hoping to adopt this into habit forever to help my physical and mental health. The routine starts with waking up super early.
Yes, it is 7:33 a.m. and oh man, this is the earliest I've been up since the pandemic started. Legit.
I make my side of the bed and go downstairs to the kitchen to drink a tall glass of water, then take my probiotics pills as part of this new routine. Beetlebub obviously follows me and...
Yeah? What? Yeah? What is this? What is this?
I guess my daily routine, old or new, still includes my cats distracting me, and it stays consistent almost every day. So have I with this new routine, and I'm starting to feel less depressed since having a bit more structure in my life. So after my water and pills, I set up on the couch for some meditation, after which I will do some basic floor exercises for movement. I've always hated meditating because I can't ever sit still. But I know it can be helpful to someone with my kind of ADHD, so I'll give it a try.
With each beat, may it take you deeper within at this time, into the internal experience of your own being.
Okay, hold on. I can't listen to my heart right now.
I don't hear it, so can you, like, go slower? I'm proud to say that I've consistently stuck with this routine for at least 3 days despite all the distractions and the constant temptation to quit. I feel confident that I will be able to implement this routine, hopefully for the rest of the year and maybe even my life. We gather today to pay our respects to Jay's daily new routine. Unfortunately, it did not survive after those glorious 3 days of consistency. The routine was no match against Jay's desires to drown her depression in fancy cheese, bread, and stretchy pants. The routine is survived by Jay's couch potato lifestyle and shall live in our memories forever. Rest in peace, routine. I doubt you will be missed.
Really great work, Jay. And hey, send us your slice of life audio. Record it on your phone or however you want and email it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.